cowboys went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Danny Pinner, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we'll be reading two selections from Cowboy Stories, Volume 5, Number 2, published in March 1927, so these stories are almost 100 years old. And I remind you that our stories are sometimes edited for recording. The first tale is entitled The Whistling Cowpuncher by Fred B. Mickelson. Sheriff Cupper tilted his whittled pine chair against the front of Jim Ford's livery and feed stable, hung his Stetson over his left knee, and settled himself for another hour of dozing. It made little difference that the sun had just dipped behind the swayback barn, and that he had already slept away the greater part of the late summer afternoon. With the exception of the effort required in battling off an occasional fly, he was at peace with the world. But this was soon to be disturbed. In the midst of his siesta, Shorty McGraw pounded up on a lathered pony. "Wake up, you jughead!" he called as he vaulted his pudgy frame from the saddle. He stood with bow legs apart, and his black eyes, like periods, glared at the sheriff. The sheriff stirred sleepily and transferred his hat from the top of his knee to the crown of his bald head. His dull gray eyes opened for a minute and fell again without signs of perturbation. "How in hell can you lay there pounding your ear while the whole country is alive with hoss rustlers?" Shorty shouted. A dumpy, red-faced man, attracted by the racket, came to the door. It was Jim Forbes, the stable owner. Shorty tossed him the reins. Sheriff Cupper yawned and jiggled his chair from the barn wall. "What's that you're coyotin' about, Shorty? The way you yap, you'd think something was wrong. If half as many hell raisins went on around here as you tell about, you know dang well that Sheriff Cupper'd be the first man to ride out of this town of Bullhead, South Dakota, with both guns cocked." "I ain't crying about the protection you give this town of Bullhead County of Buffalo," Shorty retorted. "But I ain't been chasing a hoss thief through the canyons of Squaw Creek for nothing." The sheriff simultaneously raised his eyelids and a sun-bronzed hand to adjust his crooked hat. "Yeah?" he queried. "Yeah, there's been a lot of rustling going on in the Squaw Creek country lately. Come to think of it, Cack Allison was telling me that rustlers was worrying old man Hatfield. They ain't bothered him yet, he says, and he only lives 5 miles up the creek." Shorty's reply was delayed while swift thoughts chased through his mind. "Yes, right," he blurted finally. "Sheriff, you got about as much idea what's going on around here as a groundhog has about sleigh riding. Get this right. I chased a hombre through the breaks west of old man Hatfield's place till I run him down. Sort of a gangling buckaroo with eyes like a pin o' pony's and an axe-handle nose. He looks at me like a locoed rattlesnake when I catches up with him and says, 'What can I do for you?' and then starts whistling a tune. 'Going someplace?' I asks him. He sort of unwrinkles his face and says, 'Yeah, I thought I'd go into town and blow the foam off a few.' 'Must be powerful dry,' I says, 'riding at that clip.' 'It ain't the drought I'm bothered with,' he says. 'It's just the rapid gait of this old plug I'm riding. He's sure a glutton for miles, and won't turn a hair for an hour.' 'Mighty fine animal if he's gentle,' I agrees. 'But where'd you come from?' 'Just riding through,' he says, and forks off again about this buckskin mustang. 'Look at the chest on him and the muscles in them forelegs,' he says, 'and this black stripe down his back. If you know anything about hoss flesh, might tell you how tough he is. He's lady broke and gentle, except when he goes to bucking, and then you cowboys want to have both hands empty for pulling leather. The blank expression on Sheriff Cupper's face had changed to one of interest. "Cax said he'd seen a rider on a buckskin hoss around there," he droned. After a moment's reflection, he added, "Who do you reckon this ganglin' buckaroo is?" "For God's sake, I've been telling you. He's a hoss thief pausing ignorant to keep his head out of the noose," Shorty said noisily, but was thinking more about the buckskin horse than about what he was saying. The sheriff frowned. "Better keep an eye on him then, huh?" Shorty faced Jim Forbes at the stable door and turned both thumbs down. "Says we better keep an eye on him. Right wide awake, Sheriff, eh, Jim?" "Well, Sheriff," he says, facing him again, "I ain't asking you to lose any beauty sleep to catch a hoss thief, but if you'll give me the authority, I'll appoint myself a committee to keep him straight round here." "Don't know as I ever stood in your way," the sheriff said, twirling the points of his dun mustache. Shorty gestured for silence and stepped to the corner of the barn. He lowered his hat and peered into the early twilight sun. "Hang on to your derbies, boys," he called. "I can't see him, but that noise you hear is him. He'll come blowing in here quick like a spring chinook on a stampede." The whistling puncher galloped around the opposite corner of the stable, the steel-shod feet of his buckskin beating on the hard-packed turf. "Howdy," he greeted between notes, and swung leisurely from the saddle. He whistled to the end of the tune. "Do you have to screw your face up that-a-way to whistle, or is it natural?" Shorty addressed him. "It's natural. Whistling always did come easy," he answered, stretching his face in a molar grin, the skin pulling tight over the point of his axe-handle nose. "If you're going to whistle round this shank of the range, you better take to selling peanuts to protect it, or somebody'll put a bullet in your air tank," said Shorty. The puncher hitched up his Angora chaps and notched the belt around his lean hips. "I usually get along well, all right," he laughed. "You probably get along, but what direction you're riding when you do?" Shorty fired back. "Don't know, except it won't be west," came the half-challenging reply. The hidden sheriff stepped forward with authority. The puncher turned to stroke his buckskin's nose. "He's the best cayuse that ever nibbled a stubble off in a hill. Gentle as a kitten, except when you fire a gun from his back, then..." "There's 3 feet of that stuff in the shed over yonder," the sheriff cut in. "I ain't disputing that the hoss is all right, but ain't you herded him just a little too long?" The whistling puncher's droll voice crackled a little. "If you ain't too proud, do you mind telling me who you are?" he asked. Sheriff Cupper pulled back his coat. The weight of a polished badge made wrinkles in the lower part of his checkered vest. "This bunker plate might let you know who I am." He smiled smugly and swaggered back to his chair. During the sheriff's inning, Shorty had been wondering how he might euchre this human calliope out of his buckskin horse. "Want to swap that crowbait? Got a horse in here that sure can split the breeze," he said. "Ain't swapping horses today, but I'll swap anything else from hats to chaps." "You ain't swapping hats or chaps with me," Shorty retorted. He pointed to his sombrero. "See that beaded band? Made right on the hat? And them solid nickel conches on my chaps got my monogram on 'em. Whenever you see anything with SM on it, belongs to me." Having heard enough about Shorty's haberdashery, the puncher led his horse into the stall and unsaddled. He went whistling out of the barn and across the barren lot that lay between the stables and the town. "See you in the morning," he called to the sheriff and Shorty in passing. Shorty nudged the sheriff. "You stick to his trail," he said, squinting his eyes. The sheriff gazed back at him for a moment with the expression of a Boy Scout. "You leave that to me," he hazarded. The puncher stopped to look around at the pump and watering trough which stood in the center of the lot. Away from the barn, he could see across several miles of Bronze Prairie to the west and the south, rolling on until the swells lost themselves in the heights of Antelope Divide. A long buggy shed cut off his view to the north, and to the east, the half-dozen buildings that were the town, left to his eyes narrow strips of country, brown like the erst, and tinseled with patches of sagebrush. The town, the hills, and the flats lay sluggish in the drowsy twilight. Across the street at the hitching rack, two cow ponies switched mosquitoes and tossed their heads to ward off a lingering nose fly. They indicated to him which one of the town's doors belonged to the saloon, and he strode on, the jingle of his spurs keeping time to the tune he whistled. Inside the saloon, he noticed several cowhands, well along with Hooch, at the bar. Several others filled the chairs in the rear of the room. Still whistling, the puncher bellied up and ordered a round for the house.
"Well, here's to you and that tune you's whistling. Ain't heard gonna be a ball in the old town hall since I was up on Milk River," a drunken cowboy said, and sprung a flow of tobacco juice in the general direction of the spittoon. "Gonna be working around here?"
"Just blew in from Thunderhead country to soak up a little," the puncher answered evasively.
"It's powerful dry up there, and I don't want the hoops to fall off in this old barrel of mine." "Gonna be around here?" the soak repeated.
"Yeah," the puncher said in an offhand manner. "Gonna work for old man Hatfield during the round trip." The drinking continued, but the puncher was not only absorbing beer. Over the top of his glass, he watched the back door. He saw Sheriff Cupper enter and stand for a moment in the semi-darkness. Furtively, the sheriff went to an empty poker table and found a chair, pulling his black Stetson down until the brim was parallel with the pitch of his nose. He watched the men at the bar, eagerly for a time, but soon nodded and shortly fell asleep. For more than an hour, he sat snoozing with arms locked across his chest, and the precariously balanced Stetson threatening to tumble with each snore. The cowboys toasted the alertness of Bullhead Sheriff, but his siesta was not to be interfered with until Doggy Lampman decided to give him a beer shampoo.
"Gad dang your hide, Doggy," the sheriff yelled, springing from his chair, blowing beer. "I got a notion to lock you in the hoosegow and throw the key away. You ain't got the sense of a wore-out saddle blanket."
"No, Sheriff, you're letting your temper stampede with you. Here's how it happened. I was bringing you a little snifter when this maverick Hank got to prancing and spilled the eyedropper full on your head."
The sheriff laid a hand on Doggy's shoulder and steered him aside. Excitement blazed in his face.
"Where'd that dang whistling cowpuncher get to? Anybody see him?"
"Being gone an hour," Doggy consoled.
Sheriff Cupper dove for the butt of his gun and dashed out the front door. The gloom of late evening hung heavily, and the sky was punctured by a lone star that stood in the smudgy streak above Antelope Divide. It winked as if its bidding were to light the world alone. The bronze prairie that unfolded in the semi-darkness seemed to have been transmuted to wrought iron. The sheriff hastened past the sleeping cowponies and went to the livery stable. The sliding door, which rolled on a sagging track, stood open barely far enough to let him squeeze through. He went to the stall where the whistling puncher had left his horse. It was empty. Shorty's horse was gone, too, he noticed. He swore and wiped the moisture from his forehead. Awakened by the sheriff's cursing, Jim Forbes came to the door of the office.
"What'll you have?" he growled, as was his manner with late customers.
"Where's Shorty?" the sheriff called back. "That dang whistling puncher is gone."
"Shorty said to tell you that he had to ride back home and he'd see you in the morning," Jim said, and yawned cavernously.
"Just like that dang hoodlum to be gone when—"
The sheriff stopped short, and with more speed than he had applied to his legs since Butte County was a territory, he went to the hotel.
"What's up?" the keeper asked, reading excitement in the sheriff's face. "Seen anything of that gangling buckaroo that blew into town tonight? Got a room here, ain't he?"
The keeper nodded affirmation. Sheriff Cupper's jaw dropped. He stood rubbing his chin whiskers, then walked from the hotel.
Sheriff Cupper was glum the next morning as he sat with his dusty boots thrown over the corner of his desk, wondering what he'd tell Shorty about the Whistling Puncher's getaway. He was still pondering those effortless thoughts when he heard the clank of spurred feet on the boardwalk. It was Shorty and Cack Allison coming to see him. "What's up?" the sheriff called as they entered the office, trying to smile naturally. "What in tarnation happened, Shorty? Looks like the wolves have been after you." Shorty glanced self-consciously at his right hand, the thumb of which was bandaged and splinted.
"Went up in the loft to throw down some hay for my hoss, and I like to fell through the feed hole," he answered. "God dang it, I lost a couple of conches off my chaps to boot. Nickel-plated and had my monogram on them, too."
Suddenly Shorty's mood changed, and he drew the corners of his mouth down in a sneer.
"I suppose you think you can ride that swivel chair in the roundup after this murderin' thief you was so careful to let get away last night. Did he pat you on the cheek and tell you he didn't mean no harm?"
Shorty bunted open the gate in the railing that set off the sheriff's desk from the remainder of the office and eyed him nastily. Cack settled against the rail and spun a spur rowel with the toe of his opposite foot.
"Who put a cactus under your saddle blanket?" the sheriff muttered sullenly.
Shorty's eyes flashed and he raised his voice.
"The same person that forget to put one in the seat of your chair."
The sheriff looked down his nose.
"Dang you, Shorty," he warned. "What in tarnation is eating you?" "Sit still, sheriff. It ain't worth bothering about. Just a little killing and 50 or 60 head of hosses stole."
Sheriff Cupper rose quickly. "Who's been killed?"
"You ain't expected to know," Shorty lipped. "Maybe you'd better tell him, Cack. I ain't got the heart."
Cack pushed back his Stetson and shifted a brown paper cigarette to the other corner of his mouth. His mild gray eyes took in Shorty's length for some time, and then he spoke.
"There ain't much to tell," he began slowly, "except that old man Hatfield was killed last night, and a bunch of hosses stole. I've been looking out for him, and when I rode up this morning, I seen him laying there," Cack explained.
"Laying where?"
"At his own ranch. He's laying face down in the manure pile."
"Now what do you reckon they done that for?" the sheriff asked dumbly.
"I suppose someone tried to steal his hosses and he put up a fight. He's been penning 'em up every night lately."
"Hmm," the sheriff commented. "Did you see it too, Shorty?" "How in hell would I see it?" Shorty growled. "I seen the bird that done it, though."
"Where?"
"Where? Right here in your own peaceful little town, for God's sake," Shorty sneered. "You don't reckon that pie-faced buckaroo come down here to hold the box social, do you?"
"I'll admit," the sheriff said meekly, "that gangling coyote wasn't around these parts last night, so far as I could see."
"No, and he ain't any place round here now. I seen him leading his hoss out of the barn just before Cack come," Shorty said quietly. "Why didn't you tell me, you sheepherder?" "What good that do, sheriff? You'd probably gone out and waved goodbye." "You ain't got nothing on him anyway."
"The hell I ain't. Wasn't his hoss gone from the stable last night? And I'll soon have some handcuffs on him if I catch up to him," the sheriff fumed. With a burst of enthusiasm, he started for the door.
"Come along, men. I might need a couple extra shooting irons."
They went to the barn, and Sheriff Cupper hurried to the stall where the buckskin had been tethered. He returned wearing a look of disappointment.
"He's gone all right," he said. "Jim," Shorty mouthed, "where are you, you damned old lobster?"
Jim came trotting out.
"Where is that there buckskin hoss?" Shorty asked.
"Oh, he come and took him," Jim answered.
"When?"
"Oh, about an hour ago."
"Which way?"
I didn't pay no attention."
"What'd the hoss look like?"
"Well, he was gaunt as a greyhound, like he'd been run to death."
Shorty looked at the sheriff with an accusing squint. There ain't much question about that, is there, Sheriff? What the hell are you going to do about it?
The sheriff blinked while his none-too-efficient brain fidgeted for the answer.
Right after him, of course, he said indecisively. He lifted his hat and scratched his head. You boys get your hosses, he said.
He hastened to saddle his black gelding and sat astride him waiting for Shorty and Cack. They joined him presently, and the three rode off at a rapid pace. It was quite early, but the autumn sun had already sucked the night's moisture from the powder-dry prairie, and heat waves miraged the landscape. Alkali dust from the speeding hoofs clouded around and coated on their faces and clothing. They rode down draws here and climbed pitches there to scan the rolling stretches ahead. Higher toward the crest of Antelope Divide, they strained their eyes for a glimpse of the buckskin horse and its rider. Several miles later, Sheriff Cupper reined in.
We can't be on the right track, boys. We've been riding to beat the devil. We ain't seen him yet.
Well, what next, Sherlock?
Shorty heckled.
What do you think, Cack? The sheriff asked, baffled. Tain't far to old man Hatfield's place. Maybe we ought to go over there and pick up the clues.
Cack nodded. Shorty glowered at him and rode sullenly along.
Getting lonesome for that swivel chair, officer? He asked finally. Old man Hatfield had a chair that you could take a snooze in. Maybe hold out till you get back to town.
The sheriff pretended deafness. He dug his black with the spurs and broke to a gallop. Cack followed, but Shorty held back. After a moment's thought, he reached a decision and slashed his horse with the quirt. He came racing up alongside the sheriff.
See here, Sheriff, he began abruptly. I've been pretty tough with you. No harm meant. Thought I'd better get Longhorn to make it seem more serious to you. Anything you say goes. You're the law, and just like always, Shorty McGraw's gonna stand by you.
The sheriff shifted his eyes from between his horse's ears where they had rested for the last dozen miles.
That sounds more like you, you danged old coyote. Thought you must be full of hooch the way you was acting, the sheriff answered,
and his melancholy countenance brightened stiffly.
All right, Sheriff, we'll call it off, Shorty agreed, and he extended his hand.
The sheriff took it.
I don't want to buck in, Sheriff, Shorty began, but I think we ought to keep a-going in the direction we was headed. Just like you said, that long-nosed buckaroo is probably hit for the brakes.
Been thinking about that, the sheriff agreed, but we better go on to the ranch, seeing that we're almost there. Shorty opened his mouth to speak, but thinking better of it, coughed. They rode in silence, letting their heat-reddened eyes scan the waves of hills around them. At the bottom of a draw, they watched a whirlwind whip up the dust in a conical spiral. Just over the ridge was Old Man Hatfield's ranch, visible from the hilltop to the shimmering air. A log house, long and narrow and low, a stable of the same style, both with dirt roofs, a pole corral and a squatty, thatched roof cattle shed. Lodgepole Creek cut a crooked channel to the left of the buildings, bending in a half-circle around the stables and shed. 100 yards farther down was the water hole, the justification for the ranch site. A scraggly cottonwood tree with yellow-edged leaves was mirrored in the water. A bunch of white-faced cattle, which had come earlier in the day to drink, now chewed their cuds in the shade of the tree, or stood knee-deep in the stagnant water. Shorty took off his hat to get the cooling effect of a breeze that brushed over the tip of the hill.
"She's sure a scorcher today, ain't she?"
he asked abstractedly.
"Sure is," Cack economized, speaking for the first time since they set out.
There were no further words as the riders rocked through the waterless creek bed and skirted the fence that enclosed the haystacks. They dismounted in front of the stable, and Cack led the way to the body on the manure pile.
"I guess he's dead all right," the sheriff remarked solemnly. Guess we better get that cowhide on the corral fence and carry him out of these gnats and blowflies. He stood in deep thought for a moment. There ain't nothing mean enough for that dang whistling pirate for shooting a man down in cold blood just for a few head of hosses, he said philosophically. Cack and Shorty turned to get the cowhide from the fence. Hold on, the sheriff called. What's this? He pointed to the imprint of a booted foot turned in the direction of the barn. Listen, Cack interrupted, holding up his hand. After a silence, he said, Thought I heard a horse stamping, but I guess not. During that moment, an eerie sense of mystery had charged the air. The dead body on the ground seemed now to cast a weird reflection over the entire ranch basin. The breathing of the three men became softer as they listened for stamping feet. Cack and Shorty turned to get the cowhide. They had not gone far when nearby came the unmistakable whinny of a horse. In the barn, Cack whispered. He reached reflexively for his gun. Slip around and watch the feet hole in the rear. Sheriff, watch the front door, and I'll keep the side door guarded. They went to their places with guns drawn, watching the openings and crevices of the barn. As they closed in, they heard distinctly the jingle of spurs against the hard dirt floor inside. They waited tense with expectation. Abruptly, the head and shoulders of a man framed itself in the upper half of the two-part front door. Sheriff Cupper's lower jaw went limp with fear. Throw him in the air, he managed, and he leveled his gun in all directions. As the man obeyed, steadiness crept back into the sheriff's hand. The usual firmness returned to his limp jaw. The blurred outline of the man he faced took on a familiar shape. Gradually he realized he faced the whistling cowpuncher. This way, boys, the sheriff called, and the boys came running. Well, if it ain't our tuneful friend that rides the buckskin hoss, Shorty smirked. The whistling puncher narrowed his eyes in a grin, and the white spot on his nose loomed larger as the skin stretched tight over the point. Better do your chessy catting now, Shorty addressed him. It ain't gonna be so funny after a while. Cack's eyes were cemented on the puncher. Better step out from behind that door, he said. Anything to please you, gentlemen, or you either, Shorty McGraw, the puncher answered, kicking the door open with his foot. He came forward deliberately, his hands above his head. Why don't one of you come and get this shooting iron out of my northwest hip pocket, he wanted to know. This is a powerful, tiresome position, if you ask me. Go ahead and get it, Cack, the sheriff ordered. I'll keep him covered. Cack obeyed, slipping the big .45 caliber Colt into his own hip pocket. His hands by his side, and all the guns out of sight, the whistling puncher felt easier. He faced Shorty. What's the matter with your thumb, Shorty? Been twiddling 'em too much? He asked dryly, his eyes twinkling. Shorty glowered. Yeah, it's funny, ain't it, to see a man with a sore thumb? Do you still want to swap me for the buckskin hoss? The puncher cut in flippantly. Don't be any more of a jackass than you have to, Shorty sneered again. Well, maybe you'd like to ride him around the lot and shoot a few times from his back. He's lady broke and gentle until you go to shooting off in his back, and then, believe me, he's a fence-rolling, sun-fishing fool. He's awful hard to ride, too, ain't he, Shorty? Shorty's black eyes flared like fan coals, and he fastened them on the puncher's half-smiling face. What do you think you're getting at, you night-riding coyote? Shorty raved. You can peddle that stuff to the convicts down at the pen. He turned to the sheriff with a limp gesture of disgust. How long you gonna listen to that loose mouth of his run off like that? Guess we've had about enough of it, the sheriff confirmed. You watch the hombre, Cack. Shorty and me'll take a look around. What's them tracks over yonder? Shorty asked. Horseshoe prints, the sheriff answered. Sure as hell. Kicking up more dirt all the time like he was making speed.
Shorty lurched ahead. "Where'd this horse jewelry come from?" he asked accusingly, holding up a polished shoe.
"Well, I'm a dirty name," the sheriff muttered. The puncher's buckskin was wearing some.
"We'll just take a look and see if he got 'em all yet." They returned to the barn and led the buckskin out.
"It's off in his left forefoot. See, it's plumb gone," Shorty said, lifting the leg and fitting the shoe to the hoof.
The puncher watched Shorty from the heel of his eye.
"Yeah," he agreed. "I noticed it was gone this morning when I got the hoss from the livery stable. He must have threw it the same time you sprung your thumb."
"If I'd done right, I'd shoot you down where you stand," Shorty roared.
"Oh, yeah? Just like you done right by old man Hatfield?"
"You dirty killing cur," Shorty yelled, lunging at him.
Cax stepped between them and jerked Shorty's hand from the butt of his gun.
"Use your head," he said gruffly.
There was a moment of sullen quiet while the puncher scanned Shorty with metal eyes. "You got any idea what become of those silver conches that gone off your chaps?" he asked. He turned to the sheriff.
"Do you mind following them tracks a little farther, sheriff? You'll find Shorty's conches, with his monogram on 'em and all. It'd be a shame to lose 'em."
Not being able to think of an excuse, the sheriff obeyed. Shorty's knees quivered, but the anger that purpled his face and made him crunch his teeth offset any fear he may have felt.
"You damn louse-bound lion sneak. Ow."
He drew his gun viciously with full intent to kill, but Cack wheeled around in time to step between them again. They grappled.
"Damn you, Shorty, put that gun up," Cack said savagely.
For the moment, he seemed to forget that he was guarding a man suspected of murder. In a quick glance, the whistling puncher saw the butt of his gun sticking from Cack's hip pocket. Whirling deftly on his heel, he grabbed it. As quickly, he backed off, leveling the big black .45 and cocked it. "All right, boys, now cut out that wrestling and drop them guns," he drawled. There was a pause.
"And be quick about it," he added huskily.
They knew without looking that they were covered. Cack's gun thudded to the ground, and Shorty's followed.
"I don't like the looks of your ugly faces. Swear to God they'd gag a mule. Guess you'd better march over and face the barn wall," the puncher chided.
"Forward march!"
"Hip, hip, hip,"
he sang out as his quarry marched ahead of him. Glancing quickly over his shoulder, he saw the sheriff returning. His eyes were glued on objects he carried in his hand.
"Here comes the sheriff with your pretties, Shorty. You can put 'em back on your chaps so they won't look so cussed ugly."
His gun swung slowly around on the sheriff.
"You too, sheriff. Better put 'em in the air till we get this little matter straightened out. All right, it won't be painful if you listen to what I say. But hang on to them leather decorations."
The sheriff's hands went up like signals at a railroad crossing. His eyes were bulged and bewildered. The puncher relieved him of his gun and the conches, rewarding him with a pleasant grin.
"Better go over and hide your face with them other hombres. We're playing a little game of button-button. Who owns the buttons?"
When the sheriff had lined up, the puncher whirled his gun twice on his index finger and closed in behind Shorty.
"Ever see these before, Shorty? Pretty, ain't they?" he said, holding up the conches.
"Remember you told me yesterday that any time I saw anything with SM on it, it belonged to Shorty McGraw? And I'm sure willing to believe a man when he tells me anything. You know, if you'd have believed me when I told you the buckskin pitched a little when you shot off in his back, you wouldn't have got your thumb broke or lost your conches. Just a little before dark, I went down to the stable and my hoss was gone, and you was the only man I couldn't find in town. In the morning, you both showed up again. It's an old trick of yours to ride somebody else's hoss when you go out thieving, ain't it? But you pulled it just once too many times." The smile left the puncher's face.
"It's a damn good thing you put your crow bait out in the buggy shed.
or you'd have had company coming home this morning," he added. After a silence, he went on. "It ain't so funny now, is it, Shorty?"
"No." "I guess old man Hatfield could tell you how funny it is if he could sit up on that manure pile and tell you he sent for me to come down and help clean out you rustlers." Shorty cast an unclean look over his shoulder. The puncher's grin returned, broader than before.
"You don't believe it, huh?" he laughed. "Well, you can do just as you're a mind to about that. Maybe the judge will be interested in this. Let's have them bracelets, Sheriff, and I'll fix this bird.
Then you boys can get your hands down," the puncher chuckled. "He wasn't so hard to catch, was he, Cack?" he went on, slapping Cack on the shoulder. "But can you imagine a hoss thief who goes along with the posse to help catch hisself?"
Cack joined the puncher in a few guffaws. The sheriff turned around with a 3-for-a-nickel expression and handed over the handcuffs.
"Well, I'm a dirty name," he muttered dully. And that was The Whistling Cowpuncher by Fred B. Mickelson. Now we will read Left-Handed Relations by Peter A. Lay. On a ranch just outside of St. David's, Arizona, old Jim Robeson fondles his gun and swears he will get the man who robbed him. But he never has. He was able to give only a meager description. But on one point he was positive. The outlaw was short, with a hunch between his shoulders, walked as if he had been lamed, and Robeson speaks scathingly of him as Camelback. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, a young chap and his wife talk in affectionate tones of a pony called Pinto and its rider who gave them happiness and wealth. They wish they knew his name, but somehow they never found out. On the edge of the Mojave Desert in California sits the richest claim owner, counting the percentage of gold that comes out with the sand from his mine, grinning to himself cheerfully as he contemplates his next adventure. Thomas William Strait was brought up in a small town in Pennsylvania on a diet of stepmothers. He had 2 before he was 12, and 3 years later, when his father announced his intention of marrying again, Thomas William ran away. He didn't remember his own mother, but he was sure that she was unlike any of the women his father selected after her. He was certain that she would not beat him if he came home from school 10 minutes late, or slap his face on the least provocation. The boy was big for his age, awkward and shy, with a sensitive mouth, deep-set gray eyes, and jet-black hair. The first man to give him a job owned a coal yard. He found him willing and eager for work. In the course of 6 months, the heavy loading and unloading in the yard found his shoulders stooped, his legs and arms too long, and his hands hard and calloused. Then his employer's wife, who had been kind to him, died and left a little girl of 3, Thomas William's own age when his mother had been taken from him. In a few months, the husband was calling on the richest widow in town, and Strait left on his next payday without saying goodbye. He was 25 when he landed at Douglas, Arizona. There was a hard and fast crowd there, and Thomas William got mixed up with them. He had done about everything there was to do, except get in jail. He'd worked on railroads in Ohio, been a taxi driver in Chicago, farmed in the Middle West, gone on tower in Oklahoma during an oil boom, rustled cattle in Texas, prospected for pay dirt in New Mexico, and just when he was offered a job in the smelter at Douglas, the crowd planned a party across the line and Strait went along. Somehow, during the wild night that followed, a man got shot. No one knew who did it, but everyone in the party carried a gun and felt guilty. The crowd separated, going in every direction save toward Douglas. In his own mind, Strait became an outlaw. The idea rather thrilled him. He saw himself a man hunted by day and night, and because his conscience was clear, he laughed and enjoyed it alone. He had about $200, and he bought himself, for 20 in silver, a good pony named Pinto,
and the two started out to make Arizona their own. There was nothing particularly definite in Strait's mind, save the decision to become an outlaw in reality. To prove to himself he could back up his desire, he planned to rob the first man who displeased him, and always to work alone. He rode his pony into the tiny village of St. David's, made friends with the young clerk in the general store there, and through him, eventually met the foreman of a large ranch nearby and was given a job. Thomas William worked hard for a couple of weeks, but he was getting impatient. All the other hands were pleasant enough, and no man who had anything worth taking had claimed his ill will. Then payday came, and with it the owner of the ranch, old Jim Robeson, as the men called him, and who rarely came near them. Spending all his time in the big ranch house, his wife left him on the state highway. Strait knew that Robeson had a daughter, Jean, who was in love with a young man by the name of York, who lived in St. David's. York wanted to marry her and go east, where a good position awaited him. But the girl's father would not allow it. This was none of Thomas William's business, and he paid scant attention when the other men talked, until one of them let drop the fact that the girl's mother was rich long before she married old Jim, and that he was Jean's stepfather.
"Stingy as hell he is, too," the man added vindictively. "It's all the kid's money, or ought to be, and he don't buy her even decent clothes. She has to do all the work in the house, too. He won't have anybody else around. He hadn't a red cent when her ma married him. Now he keeps all her money in the house. Won't let even a bank make a penny out of him. I heard he counts his coppers every night, too. Somebody sure ought to relieve him of that job."
Thomas William Strait almost fell from his bunk as he listened. All his old hatred of stepmothers came back with renewed force. And stepfathers must be even worse. This poor young girl, Jean Robeson, whom he had never seen, had one. Here was his opportunity, and with a good motive to back it up. When Robeson arrived at noon to pay the men, Strait looked him over carefully. He wanted to be sure of his man. He saw a short, stocky individual with bushy, iron-gray brows and hair. Robeson's face was weather-beaten, and his eyes were brown, narrow, and slanting. There was a slight cross in one of them. His mouth dropped at the corners, and he carried an air of inelegant arrogance that didn't set well with other men. It was just as well that he left all his ranch business to a pleasanter man. The next day, Strait asked the foreman for time off, and, because he'd not been away from the ranch since his arrival, the request was granted. He and Pinto made directly for St. David's. He had no trouble finding the young fellow Jean Robeson was sweet on. Ray York worked in the general store, and he recognized Strait at once as the man he had introduced to Robeson's foreman a month or so before. Strait thanked him again, bought some tobacco, and they engaged in conversation. After about 10 minutes, the talk seemed to come around naturally to the Robesons. "Old Jim's her stepfather, isn't he?" Strait questioned after a while. "Why'd she go and change her name to his fur?" The young man sighed. "Oh, Jean's mother wanted it. He was nice enough while Mrs. Robeson lived. But for the past 2 years, it's grown worse and worse. I've tried to coax Jean to come away with me, but she won't. Says she has no money and would have to go without clothes or anything. You know how girls generally are about things like that." Strait did not know, but nodded understandingly. York went on confidentially. "I've saved our car fare to Philadelphia, and my uncle has a big store there. He's got a place waiting for me."
"Too bad you can't persuade the young lady to go," Strait said sympathetically. "I'd like to help you out like you did me when I needed this job."
Young York sighed again.
"I guess there's nothing to do," he said ruefully, "but wait a little longer and see what happens."
"Well, why don't you make something happen?" Strait suggested subtly.
I've been doing a heap of thinking since we've been talking this over. There's a train east out of Douglas early in the morning. You set the day, and I'll try to have Miss Jean Robeson on hand in time to get married and take the drawing room.
Red York laughed. Well, I've never been able to persuade her old man, and I don't believe anybody else could either. Still, I'd be ready to do it pronto, he admitted. And by George, I believe you're on to something. I can have my car ready for the drive to Douglas, sure, but... He stopped and then added, Maybe it'll be a wild goose chase without the goose, but I'll chance it. I'd do most anything to get Jean to marry me and leave out of here. Thomas Williams smiled shrewdly as he rolled up his old sweater, put it under his shirt, and made a hump on his back. Then he pulled on an old greenish-black Prince Albert coat that he had bought that afternoon from a second-hand store in Tombstone, and surveyed the trousers that came with it. He turned them up a bit higher, then tried to picture himself. Pinto and he were out on the desert some 5 miles from the ranch. It was growing dark. Taking a brown cap from his pocket, 2 sizes too large for his head, he drew it well down over his eyes, and a bandana kerchief of red silk found its place across his chin. In his trouser pocket, he made sure he carried some stout cord. Strait was just commencing to enjoy himself. He practiced walking up and down a stretch of sand, giving his feet a peculiar sliding motion, and bending his stooped shoulders far over. The old sweater on his back added to the illusion, and from a man topping 6'2" in his socks, he seemed less than 5½. At 9:30, disguised thus, and eager for his first venture, he crouched outside the living room window of the Robesons' home. The curtains were drawn part way. It was a large, rambling, one-story ranch house with wide-windowed rooms running in all directions. Old Jim sat by his desk in the corner, and Jean Robeson stood near the center of the room talking. Thomas William could not make out what she said at first, but Robeson bellowed out words that made the other man ache to knock him down.
"Your mother's clothes will have to do," he roared. "Make them over for yourself if you need something to wear."
"But I hate to cut up mother's things," the girl answered on the verge of tears. "I just can't bear to do it somehow."
"Bosh, that's a poor excuse," the man snarled. "Well, you'll get no money from me while there's stuff here to do with."
"My mother," Jean began timidly.
"Left me in charge, young woman," Robeson interrupted rudely. "And a good thing she did, too. You'll do what I say." He brought his pudgy fist down heavily on the desk.
Jean Robeson turned, and for the first time Strait had a good look at her. She was a slim, graceful, blue-eyed girl about 18. Her skin was milk-white, and there was something sorrowful about her mouth. Her small hands kept nervously fingering the faded blue percale dress she wore. She started to answer her stepfather, then evidently thought better of it, and swiftly left the room. Robeson got up and went to the door through which she had gone, locked it quietly, and went back to his desk. The man outside watched his every move thoughtfully. Robeson unlocked a drawer and took some papers from it, spreading them out on the blotter before him. One slipped to the floor unheeded. Strait came nearer the window pane and peered in curiously. He saw a $5,000 Liberty bond on the rug at Robeson's feet. Roughly speaking, he figured that there must be at least 10 others lying on the desk. Then Robeson went to an old easy chair by the fireplace, tipped it sideways and removed one leg, let the chair down easily and returned to the desk. Very carefully, he extracted round, tissue-wrapped objects and began counting, laying one atop the other noiselessly. Thomas William grinned knowingly. Gold pieces. It would be a good night's work. A light went out in another room. He guessed that Jean had gone to bed. He began to wonder how many other hiding places Robeson had. Better not to be in a hurry. Wait a little and see what else there might be to find out. After counting some 30 or 40, Robeson put the tissue-wrapped discs back and returned the leg to the chair, gathered up his bonds, discovered the one on the floor, then locked them all in the drawer. Guess that's all he's going to count tonight, Strait ruminated to himself, and made certain of his revolver. Robeson sat down on a wide couch made up like a bed in one corner, took off his shoes, then suddenly moved out of the watcher's vision. In a moment, he was back with a heavy nightshirt. He undressed slowly, and just before putting out the light, placed a six-shooter on a chair near his head. There was a creaking of springs as he settled himself on the couch for the night. 15 minutes passed, and he was snoring regularly. Thomas William tried the window carefully, slipping his knife in at the lock. "Easy does it," he muttered as he held it fast, then allowed it to slide over gently. The window went up without a sound, and he stepped quietly into the room. With the help of his pocket flash, he had Robeson's gun in a moment, and had eased it out the window for safety. Then he leaned over the sleeping man, pressing his own revolver hard against his chest. Robeson came to with a startled exclamation.
"What the—" he began. "Don't speak again till I tell you," Strait whispered threateningly in his ear. "If you move, this gun of mine's likely to speak pronto. Understand? Nod your head."
The flashlight turned full on Robeson's face. He nodded dumbly.
"All right, now do as I say and be quick. Get out of bed, go to your desk, sit down, get some paper and a pen."
Thomas Williams' voice was a hoarse, croaking noise. Robeson looked wildly around for his gun. Had he forgotten to put it in the usual place for the night? But a heavy pressure of Strait's pistol silenced him effectively. He obeyed. When he was seated, Strait directed,
"Now write what I say. Pronto."
Robeson's hand trembled so he could scarcely hold the pen.
"To my stepdaughter, Jean Robeson, I give all my liberty bonds."
Robeson's pen stopped abruptly. Strait's revolver pressed into his side eloquently.
"And all the gold I have hidden in the leg of the old easy chair."
The pen stopped again. Thomas William whispered,
"Do you want to die, Robeson, right now?"
The other man shook his head.
"Then go on writing, because these things belong to Jean's mother anyhow. When you finish that, sign your name."
For half a second, Robeson hesitated, then obeyed. Strait took the paper, scanned it carefully and approvingly, then put it in his vest pocket.
"Now the bonds," he demanded quickly.
The other man searched vainly for a way out, but there was none. When he had handed them over, Strait commanded,
"Sit still,"
then bound him, hands and feet, with the stout cord from his pocket, and with a torn piece of sheet from the couch made a firm gag. Going to the chair, he took leg and all. It was so heavy, it almost made him drop his gun. Robeson tried vainly to see if he knew this man, but only succeeded in glimpsing an outlaw with a hump on his back. As Strait unlocked the door and left the room, relocking it after him, the man tried to cry out, but found he could not make a sound, nor could he possibly move. He would have to wait for someone to find him in the morning. He wondered if any of the men would be in, or if Jean had anything to do with this outrage, as he squirmed back and forth, only making himself more uncomfortable. Thomas William made his way to Jean's room and almost frightened her to death.
"Get up and dress,"
he threatened and commanded in one breath.
"Take everything you want. You're going to be gone for a long time. But if you speak or make any noise, I'll shoot you dead."
He smiled mischievously in the darkness. He'd never shot anyone in his life. 20 minutes later, with her before him in the saddle, Pinto was taking them towards St. David's as rapidly as possible. When Mr. and Mrs. York came from the office of the Justice of the Peace, Strait handed over a heavy package. Look this over on the train, he suggested slowly. And just you two keep that little slip of paper that Robeson wrote and signed, careful-like. Jean Robeson York, smiling now and happy, spoke to him. You almost scared me to pieces, though now I'm thankful you did it. But whatever made you? Thomas William grinned sheepishly. I'm paid good, Mrs. York. I kept one thing out of each kind you'll find in that package. Remember that. Now, I'm going to light out over to Mojave, where I hear there's a real fine gold strike. York laughed. You're welcome to anything I've got. But what made you do this for Jean and for me anyway? To Jean and her husband, Strait's answer was enigmatical. I sure do hate steps, and that's why, he said. To this day, they're still wondering what he meant. And that was Left-Handed Relations by Peter A. Lay. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.